Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know, around here, we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million. On the program today, a little bit of e-commerce, some fantasy sports, and supervillains to round things out. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace. In Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. It is Thursday, the 4th of August. Good as always to have you along, everybody. We interrupt our regularly scheduled programming for an emergency edition of our every now and then game show, What is Janet Yellen Thinking? You might have seen the news this morning that the Bank of England has decided, what with Brexit-induced uncertainty and all, that it's had about enough of its benchmark interest rate being all the way up at 0.5%. Bank of England Governor Mark Carney announced a quarter-point cut this morning to 0.25%, the lowest that rate has been. And get this, it's the lowest the rate has been in the 322 years that the Bank of England has been around. We, of course, with tomorrow morning bringing the July unemployment report here, got to wondering what Dr. Yellen was thinking as she heard the news. Remember the game, What is Janet Yellen Thinking? In five words or less, here's what she said.
Data.
All right. She didn't actually talk to us, though we have called many times. But she did say that what the Fed's going to do on interest rates here will depend on data 16 times in her last press conference, which is where that tape is from. Jobs report tomorrow morning, 8:30 Washington time. Dr. Yellen, if you're listening, call me. All right. Okay. Elsewhere in capitalism, retail, there was a report in the Wall Street Journal today that Walmart is going to buy Jet.com, the upstart e-commerce platform, because as big as Walmart is, it is very much an e-commerce pipsqueak as compared to Amazon. Ashley Milne-Tite reports.
Walmart's online sales have been ticking up, but not nearly as fast as Amazon's. Brian Yarbrough is a retail analyst with Edward Jones. He says everyone in retail used to react to what Walmart did. Now, Walmart is trying to keep up with Amazon. He says, in short, buying Jet.com could mean more sales for Walmart.
The Jet.com customer is a little bit higher income than your average Walmart customer, and I know Walmart has talked about trying to move up the income scale, and so it would give them an opportunity to maybe cater to a higher income customer.
Larry Shiguras is a professor of marketing at Pace University. He says if Walmart buys Jet, it's an admission that Walmart couldn't conquer online on its own. But he says if the two companies merge, they could.
I think it's going to be a formidable competitor to Amazon, simply because Jet will benefit from the existing purchasing power that Walmart has and the existing sophisticated logistics and supply chain management that Walmart has.
And Walmart will benefit from Jet's technology. Paula Rosenblum of RSR Research says the company's algorithm determines the best price and shipping depending on where a product is shipping from.
And so they'll give you all kinds of deals if you're willing to take slower shipment, if you're willing to deal with a different kind of return process. It's kind of cool, actually, and it's probably what I'll call their secret sauce.
If the deal goes through, Walmart will reportedly pay about $3 billion. I'm Ashley Milne-Tite for Marketplace.
We're kind of in a professional sports dead zone in this country right now. Nothing big going on. Olympics haven't quite started yet. So thank God there's fantasy sports, huh? New York Governor Andrew Cuomo has signed legislation that'll let companies like FanDuel and DraftKings do their thing in the Empire State. Those companies are going to be taxed, too, with the state figuring it'll eventually raise $4 million a year for education. The key to all of this is that New York now recognizes daily fantasy sports as a game of skill rather than pure chance, a position that could have big implications nationwide for the future of this multi-billion dollar business. Marketplace's Mark Garrison is on that one from New York.
Here's how daily fantasy works. You pick players from across a professional sports league, making a fantasy team. If your fantasy team does well, you can win prize money. Fantasy players are way more engaged than regular fans. They watch and spend more, says Nola Aga, sports management professor at University of San Francisco.
Now, instead of watching just the National League, if the Giants are my favorite team, now I'm watching the American League. Now I'm watching my competitors because I have a vested interest in how the players on those other teams are doing, even if I'm not necessarily a fan of those other teams.
Daily fantasy entry fees alone will be $4.2 billion this year, according to a forecast from research firm Eilers & Krejcik Gaming. New York is now saying that winning at daily fantasy requires skill, researching players, crunching data, and forecasting performance. Robert Williams is executive director of the New York State Gaming Commission.
It wasn't the same thing as putting a dollar in a slot machine and pulling a handle.
There are daily fantasy players in most states, but the law is often unclear as to whether it's a legal game. Daily fantasy companies hope other states will follow New York's lead, with a clear legal framework and emphasis on skill over pure luck. All the legal uncertainty has taken its toll.
There's just a big cloud over the entire fantasy industry.
Peter Schenke chairs the Fantasy Sports Trade Association.
It was really hard to get investment dollars for companies, payment processors were leaving our industry, and it just kind of impacted everyone. And with the New York law, that kind of hopefully turns the tide on that and makes it more smooth sailing for our industry.
In New York, I'm Mark Garrison for Marketplace.
On Wall Street today, less than exciting. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. About a year ago, I did an interview with a guy by the name of Andy Greenberg. He's a writer at Wired, and we were talking about what had seemed like a near-death experience he had had driving a Jeep that, while he was driving it, had been hacked by a couple of researchers. Chrysler has done a recall and patched that particular vulnerability, but that is not quite the end of the story. Andy's got a couple of new articles up at Wired, more about car hacking. Andy Greenberg, it's good to have you back.
Good to be here again.
I confess that I read your most recent articles about these car hacking guys with the faint hope that you were going to tell me it was all figured out and cars were not hackable. And I got to tell you, I was a little disappointed.
Well, to be clear, a lot of things have been fixed since last year. What I was writing about this year really isn't an over-the-internet hack. It's an attack that requires physical access to the vehicle. It's kind of meant to show, from these researchers' point of view, what they could have done if they were really evil hackers who had kept this attack secret for another year and just kept working on it without telling Chrysler and helping them to fix that problem a year ago.
Give it up. What can they do? What could they have done had they wanted to?
So they can now turn the steering wheel at any speed, and they demonstrated that on themselves. Luckily, not me this year.
There's a great video clip, actually, on the Wired website, which shows this thing going like into a cornfield, right?
That's right, into a ditch. They had to get towed out. But you know what they're saying is that there could easily be another remote vulnerability found that could allow somebody to do that over the internet wireless attack again. Or, you know, this is a lesson about what an evil hacker could have done if they hadn't helped the company publicly to fix the problem.
Yeah. A word here about sort of the future of driving. As we go to cars that are autonomous and are driven by computer code, which will have to be updated and which will have to interact with, you know, traffic signals and infrastructure and all that, this is a big, big deal.
Well, that's right. I mean, what Charlie and Chris, these two researchers, have done is basically hijack existing, you know, features. Mm-hmm. So imagine a vehicle that has essentially automated features that do everything. Once you hijack that vehicle's computer, you can really remote control it to a degree that you can't with existing vehicles. Yeah.
You were driving the car last year when you wrote that piece, right, that these guys hacked into?
Yeah, that's right.
What was it like? The only thing they did was like disconnect the transmission or something, right? They threw it into neutral or something weird?
Yeah, I mean, that doesn't sound like such a serious thing, except that I was stranded on a highway with no shoulder with a big rig truck like creeping up behind me. They were telling me, you know, just turn the car off and on again to get it restarted, and that wasn't working, and they were blasting the radio, which they had taken over as well. It was a kind of panic-inducing you know, trauma for me. But luckily, you know, that is not possible anymore, thanks to the fact that they publicized that attack.
Mm-hmm. There is also a Wired piece I want to talk to you about real quick about big rig trucks and how vulnerable they are.
That's right. I think that, you know, that may actually even be a scarier piece of research than Charlie and Chris's second Jeep hack. But a group of researchers at the University of Michigan found that just by plugging into the truck's network, and this is a 33,000-pound industrial vehicle, they could send very easily a set of commands to cause it to accelerate. They think they could have blown out the engine if they had wanted to. To be clear, I don't want to scare consumers in general, sure, but these are things that the the auto industry, and now the industrial auto industry really needs to pay attention to.
You are, we should say, we got you in Vegas. You're at a couple of black hat hacking conferences and a DEF CON hacking conference. What is the mood in the cybersecurity world right now?
I'm seeing, maybe for the first time, a little more of a focus on trying to fix things, trying to actually build mitigations into software. There's a little less of a focus on blowing stuff up.
Andy Greenberg is a senior writer at Wired Magazine, talking about hacking and cars and hacking cars. Andy, thanks a lot.
Thanks, Kai.
For decades now, Children's Medical Center in Dallas, Texas, has partnered with academic institutions to come up with ways to care for sick patients. Now that model is shifting a little bit, though. The hospital is investing in tech startups to care for healthy kids. From KERA in Dallas, Lauren Silverman reports.
If you want to see where the future of kids' health is going, look inside Riley Kinman's stomach.
Hi, my name's Riley. I'm 5 and I had a kidney transplant from my dad.
On a video filmed at the hospital, Riley is about to swallow a tiny white pill with an embedded sensor, roughly the size of a grain of sand. When it reaches her stomach, it will send a signal to a patch she's wearing on her skin. And from wherever she is, school, home, sleepaway camp, it will alert her parents and doctors she's taken her medication to make sure her new kidney isn't rejected. It's the first time a children's organization has adopted the technology in a pill created by Silicon Valley-based company Proteus Digital Health.
See, look, it says, take your test pill.
Children's hospitals are searching for the best way to monitor patients remotely and keep them out of the ER. Digital health startups are looking for patients to test their products. Julie Hall Barrow, Senior Director of Healthcare Innovation at Dallas Children's Medical Center, says keeping kids healthy means partnering outside of the hospital.
I think if we weren't looking at technology to help us do that, we're never going to move much further.
To reach kids at home, Children's has acquired a controlling interest in a Dallas startup called Mend. It's an Uber-like service where a caregiver comes to your home or office for a checkup. Pete Perialis, who oversees investments for Children's, says on-demand health apps like Mend were struggling to please their customers, parents, because they weren't connected to a larger health network.
The theory of the case was that what people wanted was convenience and an app. These companies gave them convenience and an app. What we as an industry missed, again, was they also wanted to extend the relationship with their network of caregivers.
So Children's Medical Center brings parents the long-term patient-doctor relationship, and the startup brings the technology. Both could benefit, but Carmen Balber says for patients, the pairing of tech startups and private hospitals isn't necessarily ideal. She's executive director of California-based Consumer Watchdog.
When you combine medical privacy, which is so protected at a hospital, and technology companies who want to do nothing more than exploit data for the maximum profitability, we see real concerns.
Balber says federal privacy laws don't automatically apply to third-party vendors. Hospitals have to make privacy protections explicit in their partnership agreements. And, of course, even if everyone is following the rules, there's still the risk of a data breach.
We all know that if you have a startup, it's often running on the seat of its pants. Are they investing in the strongest technology to secure patients' data?
Still, healthcare systems across the country are trying this model, funneling money and resources into smaller outside companies. Last year, Boston Children's teamed up with a startup accelerator called Rock Health. Inova Health System in Virginia launched a $100 million venture fund for startups. And Kaiser Permanente invested in a group called Startup Health.
Only a few years ago, it was almost impossible even to get a meeting with some of these institutions.
Unity Stokes is president of Startup Health, which invests in and coaches startups.
And now you're seeing some of the leading healthcare companies not only invest in, but start to commercialize and work with some of these young emerging companies.
The payoff for both sides could be big. Think back to that sensor-enabled pill. Children's Medical Center in Dallas has plans to help manufacture the medication and potentially make money from it. These new partnerships will make some people feel safe, like Riley's parents, who won't have to worry she's missed a pill while at sleepaway camp. they'll make some people nervous about data privacy and ethics. And hospitals, they could earn a little extra revenue. In Dallas, I'm Lauren Silverman for Marketplace.
Coming up, superhero sounds. Pay attention, there's going to be a quiz. But first, let's do the numbers. Dow Industrials off 2 points today, less than a 10%, closed at 18,352. The NASDAQ up 6 points, about a 10%, 5166. The S&P 500 barely moved at all, 21.64. As we mentioned earlier, Walmart may be in the market to buy web retailer Jet.com, a sign it's looking to become more competitive online. Walmart picked up nearly a 0.5%. Amazon delivered 0.8%. A look at how a couple of British companies fared after the Bank of England's move to cut interest rates. How about that? British banking and financial services giant HSBC Holdings secured 2.5%. Unilever up 0.5%. It is Anglo-Dutch, but, you know, it owns Marmite, so that tips the balance over to the UK, right? Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year... Marmite. I don't understand Marmite. Bonds rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 1.50%, 1.5%. You're listening to Marketplace. This is Marketplace. I'm Kai Rizdahl. Donald Trump let it be known yesterday that he's doing quite well in the fundraising department. Between them, his campaign and the Republican Party brought in $82 million last month. The question now is what he's going to spend it on. Because even for as unusual and free media-oriented a run as he is making, the amount that Trump is spending on television ads, a mainstay of most national campaigns, has been close to nothing. Marketplace's Nancy Marshall-Genzer takes a look at the possible costs and benefits of waiting for TV time.
Hillary Clinton and super PACs supporting her have budgeted $100 million for TV ads between now and the presidential elections. That's $99 million more than Donald Trump and his super PACs have budgeted. Those numbers are from Sarah Briner at the Center for Responsive Politics.
It's such a stark difference that it's hard to believe that they're real.
But numbers don't lie. And here are some others. The Trump campaign reported raising around $80 million last month. Now that he's sitting on a pile of cash, will Trump finally break into TV? We don't know. The Trump campaign didn't respond to our interview requests. But even if Trump does decide to jump into TV now, he may not get the ad slots he wants, says David Caputo, professor of political science at Pace University.
If those time slots are gone, they're gone. So that's the disadvantage of being late.
By now, other candidates have already snapped up primetime slots. Why? Because TV works, says Steve Passwader. He's vice president and general manager at Kantar Media CMAG, which tracks campaign spending.
The fact that the electorate tends to skew a little bit older, you know, I think that also helps TV a lot.
Because those older, reliable voters still tune into TV. Passwader says politicians also like to run ads during big events that everyone watches. Planning to watch the Olympics? Then brace yourself for this.
I'm Donald Trump, and I approve this message.
I'm Hillary Clinton, and I approve this message.
So far, Trump has relied on social media and free media, and he could keep doing that. But Passwader couldn't think of any modern candidate who's won the presidential race without hitting the TV airwaves hard. In Washington, I'm Nancy Marshall-Genzer for Marketplace.
Gender identity and LGBTQ issues have been at the center of the national conversation lately. They were highlighted at both political conventions, and in North Carolina, the bathroom debate continues. A similar case in Virginia could be headed to the Supreme Court. As political causes that intersect with pop culture often do, gender identity is also finding its footing in the fashion business. Marketplace's Rima Crace explains.
Last year, Tim Kading watched a TEDx video about gender and sexuality. Activist Io Tillett Wright was giving the talk.
Human beings start putting each other into boxes the second that they see each other.
Kading, who's a partner in the clothing company Mother Denim, was so struck by the talk that he contacted Tillett Wright. And together, they created a line of gender-neutral clothing.
We just thought it was a very timely thing. You know, when you work in fashion, this is a topic that comes up a lot.
The 10-piece collection includes jeans, jumpsuits, and t-shirts with messages like label-less. They're sold in about 50 boutiques across the country, and prices range from $100 to $350. Kading says the biggest challenge was designing pieces that fit all body types.
We actually used two models to fit on, a smaller female and a bigger male, and we kind of cross-referenced both of them.
Fashion has been here before, says Joe Paoletti, an American Studies professor at the University of Maryland. She says unisex clothes were popular in the 1960s during the rise of the women's movement, but styles were more traditionally masculine. Now,
there's a demand from people, mostly in their late teens and 20s, who want clothing that expresses the way they see their own gender or lack of gender.
Gender-free clothes still make up a tiny slice of the market. Some big-name retailers like Zara are moving in, but the clothes are mostly basics, like sweats and denim. Looks that completely challenge gender norms have been largely reserved for the runway, says Wendy Liebman of WSL Strategic Retail.
Will we see it in, you know, JCPenney's and Walmart and Target? I don't anticipate that anytime soon.
Liebman says for retailers experimenting with gender-free clothing, it's mostly a marketing strategy, one that says, hey, everybody is welcome here.
Whoever you are, it's all right. You don't have to think of it in terms of gender. You think of it in terms of your style preference.
She says it's fashion's response to a growing social movement. I'm Rima Crace for Marketplace.
Forget superheroes. This weekend, Warner Brothers is going to be banking on a squad of hardened criminals and outright supervillains from the DC Comics universe to save the world and perhaps the company's summertime bottom line. Suicide Squad opens tomorrow night. Our entertainment correspondent Adrian Hill is here to tell us exactly what Warner Brothers has at stake. Hey, Adrian, how are you?
I'm well, Kai. Thanks.
Tell me then, would you, what is on the line here for Warner Brothers, would you?
There's a lot. You know, Batman v Superman ended up making something like $850 million worldwide.
Really?
But it disappointed.
That's way too much, because it was just, I reject the premise of that whole movie, but that's a whole different thing.
Critics didn't like it, fans didn't like it, and it wasn't the introduction to this DC comic book world they wanted. So now that's on Suicide Squad.
Okay, so what are people saying about this clearly all-important movie for Warner Brothers?
Well, expectations are it could make anywhere from $125 to $140 million in opening weekend. People want to see it, but again, the reviews are coming in and they're not pretty.
How much headroom do you suppose there is in this genre, as it were?
A lot. Look, if you're making $800 million for a movie, $1 billion in some cases this year, you're going to see sequels and you're going to see more sequels. Where there's money, there will be sequels.
What does this say? This is a little bit sideways. What does this say, though, about the state of Hollywood in our economy today, right? All they're making are these big, huge things. And where has the artistry gone in movies? Or is that a different interview?
No, I mean, I think it's an interesting question that they need these blockbusters to be successful, to keep going. Yeah. And there are smaller movies. There aren't as many of them, it feels like, right now. But where there's the money, there will be the investment, there will be the movie.
Right.
I wonder, though, Kai, are you a fan of these movies?
Well, mostly yes, although, as I said, Batman v Superman, just I rejected the premise of it, so, you know. But,
well,
yeah.
How are you, like, a geeky fan?
No, I'm not geeky. I'm a fan en passant, in passing, yeah.
All right. So we have developed a very cool superhero, supervillain audio quiz.
Oh, all right. So I knew you guys were working on this. I have not actually played it. Just full disclosure, have not actually played it.
Kai
could
embarrass
on.
Himself, folks. Listen in. All right. Here we go.
All right.
Name a young superhero who often gets into sticky situations whose signature sound is like this. Is it Supergirl? Oh, go ahead.
It's got to be Spider-Man shooting the webby stuff. Come on. That one's easy.
I'm
going to put my headphones on both ears, though.
One for one. All right. This one's trickier.
Okay.
Next up from the superhero universe, Blue Skin whistles while he works. This is what the whistle sounds like. Can you, Kai, name that character from Guardians of the Galaxy? Is it Ronan the Accuser, Yondu, or Nebula?
Never saw that whole franchise, man.
I missed the whole thing.
I just put that down in the no column.
All right. That's Yondu. He uses whistling to control his arrow.
Okay. All right. Fine.
All right. So I'm not going to give the rest away. We've got them all over on our website. It's at marketplace.org.
You are not actually going to tell me you knew Yondu, are you?
No.
All right.
No.
Good. Because that would be phony. That would be phony. Adrian Hill is our entertainment correspondent. The quiz at marketplace.org. Yondu? Seriously?
Yondu. Write it down.
This Final note on the way out today. Chutzpah, I think, is the word you're looking for here. Michael Barrett, the head of the public defender system in the great state of Missouri, has about had it with his office being chronically underfunded. So he has used his authority to assign any member of the Missouri State Bar to a case. And he's done it by putting Governor Jay Nixon on the hook. Nixon, a Democrat, has vetoed funding increases for the defender's office the past couple of years. No response yet on the record from the governor's office. All right, we're done. The Dow off 2 points today, less than a 10%, 18,352. The NASDAQ up 0.6%, 5166. The S&P 500 flat at 2164. John Buckley, Deirdre Debke, Eve Epstein, George Judson, Suzanne Levy, Andrea Seabrook, and Betsy Streisand are the Marketplace editing staff. I'm Kai Rizdahl. We'll see you tomorrow, everybody. This is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.